This is Patrick Russell. I am interviewing Rock Merritt for the first time. This interview is taking place at La Fiere on June 5th, 2014. This interview is being conducted by the Making History Project for a project named War and Peace Memories from World War II. How are you doing, Rock?
Fine.
Let's start with how you got your nickname, Rock.
Well, I got that years ago in the CCC camp, you know. Always got in fights or something like that, and so it just stuck on, started Hard Rock, and later on the years, when I was a Corps Sergeant Major, General Emerson cut the heart off and just called me Rock. So now, if someone says, if you know Kenneth Merritt, they'll say no. If you know Rock Merritt, oh yeah, we know Rock Merritt, you know. So anyway, I've had that off and on for over 70 years, you know, period.
Tell us where you served.
Where I served? During the war?
Yes.
1st Battalion, 508th Parachute Infantry Regiment.
And what was your rank?
Same as I got on here. I jumped into Normandy as a squad leader, as a corporal of a heavy machine gun platoon.
And were you enlisted or drafted?
No, I volunteered.
And what were your service dates?
10 August 1942 to 1 December 1977, 35 years later.
Thank you for your service. That was a long time for your country.
Yeah. You're welcome.
Tell us about the Normandy campaign.
I got involved in the destruction of the Third Reich when less than 2 hours before D-Day, I was one of the 2,052 officers and men of the 508 that was on our way for our first combat jump to be in the Normandy campaign. We were part of a 3 airborne divisions that would spearhead the Normandy invasion, starting with the 82nd Airborne Division, the 101st Airborne Division, and the 6th Airborne Division. We, the 508, my outfit, we were attached to the 82nd Airborne Division. We would jump, participate around starting at 2:30 in the morning, and 3 airborne divisions would be on the ground by no later than 0300 hours on the morning of the 6th. At 6:30 that morning, 6 divisions would hit the beaches of Omaha and what have you. It should be noted, of the 9 divisions going into Normandy on D-Day, 6 of them were American divisions. You know, 3 airborne division, 3 infantry divisions. It took 120 C-47s to drop my regiment to 508. Because each C-47 only carried 17 jumpers. Today, 13 C-17s could drop my regiment today compared to what it did then. Our heavy drop capabilities were 6 300-pound equipment bundles, 4 under the belly of the plane, and 2 door bundles. Today, the Air Force has the capability of dropping a small tank. That's how much we've progressed in there. We were coming in at 400 feet. We normally jump at 11, 12, 1300. We was coming in at 400 feet. They didn't want us in the air longer than they have to. We had a choice of taking a reserve or not. I took one. I was a coward. I felt better with a reserve on it, you know. So we went in. The wind was blowing. It was terrible. Before we hit the coastline, we started receiving ack-ack. Our plane was being hit. And we finally jumped. All of us got out. We missed this drop zone right out here we supposed to jump on, you know.
You're talking about La Fiere?
Yeah.
This was, we're at the site where you jumped.
Some of them did hit it, but it was under 4 feet of water. They drowned, most of them drowned in that one, in it, right out there, you know.
This is because the Germans flooded the fields?
That's right. It's a Frenchman told me that a day before we jumped, or 2 days before we jumped, he had a strawberry patch out there. Now the water was 4 feet deep over it, you know. So anyway, I jumped. I was number two man in my stick. Hit the ground, landed in a briar patch, laying there trying to get out of my chute with 100 pounds of equipment. We did not have the quick release of the parachute like the British had. We had the old Hornet type, and it was hard to get out. We finally got out of it. I did. But while I was laying there, a C-47 on fire, coming straight at me. I said, oh God, it's going to hit me. It looked like it did, but it flew about 50 feet over my head, which looked to me like it was almost on top of me. But I could see that the troopers had jumped because the backpack of the parachute was flapping against the fuselage of the plane. Well, it crashed about 1,000 yards from me. And when it did, it lit up this whole area. And I'm in about 10 acres of hedgerows, about 10 acres hedgerows all around. And I didn't see nobody in that hedgerow but me. I kicked my equipment bundle out, which contained machine guns. I picked up my, found it, picked my machine guns up, 6 boxes of ammo, ammunition, and what have you, and headed towards the burning plane, because I knew that's where my troops were up there. I heard something on the opposite side of this hedgerow that I'm now introduced to, the French famous hedgerow. We didn't know nothing about that, but we did. I had this little cricket that the Army had issued me. Instead of using a password, I used a cricket. I snapped it once, nothing.
You're talking about the little metal device.
Yeah, we called it a cricket, you know. I called it a Cracker Jack cricket. Because we used to get them in there when I was a kid out of a Cracker Jack. I snapped it again, and this time it come back twice. I said, who's there? And a weak voice said, I am an American chaplain. I said, thank God. And I said, sir, I'm Corporal Rock Merritt. I'm a squad leader and a machine gun platoon, and I'm heavily loaded over here. Do you think you can get through that hedgerow? And he said, I think so. And he got through and he said, Corporal, what are we going to do? I said, well, sir, the first thing, do you mind carrying this ammo for me? And he said, and I quote, praise the Lord and pass me the ammunition. So I did. And he said, where are we going to go? I said, well, I was number two man in my stick, and my troops got to be forward up towards that burning plane. We're going that direction. So we took off, heading that. And between then and daylight, we picked up 35 more men, to include the highest ranking officer, a captain, Jonathan Adams, company commander, A Company 508, my battalion. You know, he took charge and says, we're going to Hill 30. I guess we got, 3 miles from Hill 30, we run into a battalion of Germans. The reason I know is a battalion, we captured a young soldier on a listening post. And when we started firing, they killed our lead scouts, wounded some of our people, and this German prisoner said, that's my battalion. You're surrounded by a battalion of Germans. We were in contact with Hill 30, Colonel Shanley on Hill 30. He told us to dig in there and defend the crossroads that we was at, you know. So we did. Now, this is where my young chaplain swung into action. While we were digging in, he went to talk to all the people we had that was wounded. Then he went to the dead. And I guess you do whatever chaplains do to dead, you know what I mean. And time he come back, we were all dug in. So he dug in next to me. You know, he figured, yeah, I'm going to stay with this corporal. So he dug in next to me.
You're the one with the big machine gun.
Yeah. Now he would carry the admiral to my machine gun, but he wouldn't fire the gun. You know, he didn't have no gun. I guess against his religion. I don't know. We jumped in there with one day's rations. Now we're D+3. And it's getting pretty rough. We're getting pretty hungry. One of our soldiers, this 37, he lost it. He went over the hedgerow with a white cloth on his bayonet. He's going to surrender. One of our soldiers went over the hedgerow and tackled him, brought him back, and I remember what he told him. He said, if you go over that hedgerow again, I'm going to kill you. Well, nobody could control him except the chaplain. He finally got a hold of him, got him under control. But I often wondered what would have happened if he had got over to that German battalion commander and said, there's only 30 people over there, or 29 people, whatever we had available fighting in. Well,
and what
wouldn't be here.
What would be the size of the German battalion?
Well, ours was about 750, and I think theirs was 500. They had a smaller battalion than we did.
So it would have been 500 to 30.
Yeah, that's what the odds would have been. So anyway, we got a call from Hill 30, Colonel Shanley, wanting some blood plasma. All the blood plasma dropped was in our area. It just happened to hand there. So we took three volunteers, a lieutenant, a corporal, and a PFC volunteered. We strapped all this blood plasma on them and headed them towards Hill 30. Well, they didn't make it. They got caught in a crossfire between the Americans on Hill 30 and the Germans. They killed the lieutenant. They shot the chin off of the PFC and the Spec 4, the corporal. We found him 3 days later wandering around in a swamp completely and didn't know where he was at. The PFC had his chin shot off. I was giving him water through a blood plasma tube when he was trying to ask me when was the seaborne troops coming. Are we supposed to have been relieved 24 hours? I didn't know what to tell him, but I looked up and I seen a 2.5-ton truck, American, with a big white star on it. I said, they're here. It was the 90th Division, Oklahoma, Texas Division. That was not the division that supposed to got to us. The one that supposed to got to us was the 4th Infantry Division. They hit the beaches on D-Day, but I understand that they was about a mile off from where they were supposed to land, and that throwed them way off on getting to us, you know. So anyway, the 9th Division had come in. They picked up our wounded. They picked the grave registration people come in and marked the graves, I guess, or what have you. And we followed them on up to Hill 30 behind their tanks and what have you. When we got up to Hill 30, then that was the assembling point for the regiment. Wasn't planned that way, but that's the way it worked out. Colonel Lindquist, the regimental commander, he was there with his group. Colonel Shanley there with his group. And now Captain Adams is there with his small group, what have you. So they picked up my light machine guns there and issued me heavy machine guns in Cosmoline. You know, we cleaned them already. We had our first hot meal that afternoon, you know.
How many days was that after?
D+3 had been 4 days, fourth day. And we cleaned up the machine gun, and seemed to me like we attacked the next day down towards Chef DuPont. I remember that. And then we attacked the rivers, hills, and villages and what have you up until the third day of July. We almost been in there a month. And we got command that the 1st Battalion would move to the hill, to the bases of Hill 131. Because on the morning of the 4th of July, 1944, the 2nd and 3rd Battalion 508 is going to go through us, the 1st. We're holding the base that county. And we were told to hold it regardless to the last man. Had A Company and B Company online. I have attached to A Company. Section of machine gun. Now I'm a buck sergeant. I got My section sergeant got killed, so I'm now a buck sergeant. So it's 6 o'clock on the morning of the 4th. The 2nd, 3rd Battalion went through us. They took Hill 131, and we marched up on that around noon, you know. And then the 2nd, 3rd Battalion was down in the valley below that, preparing to, I guess, attack Hill 95. This is probably the first time and probably the only time during the entire 82nd Airborne Division campaign that overhead machine gun was fired. To explain what an overhead machine gun firing is, you're on a ridge and it goes down like this in the hill, and the troops are down, you can fire over their heads if you use a gunner's rule. My battalion commander, Colonel Warren, he said, asked me, do I know how to fire overhead machine gun? I said, yes, sir, but you need a leader here, my platoon leader. He's not here. And I'll never forget, the colonel said, well, I do. You certainly can, sir. So we fired overhead machine gun fire over the 2nd Battalion that's going to attack Hill 195, Hill 95.
So you provided suppressing fire.
Yeah, overhead fire. I knew exactly when to lift it and what have you. History books won't tell you this, but I'm going to tell you. The 2nd Battalion, 508th Parachute Infantry Regiment, on July the 4th, had four commanders. Three of them got wounded and what have you. And the fourth one, you know, the last one that took Hill 95 was a captain. Not a battalion commander, not a major, a captain. He had run out. He took Hill 95, then he got replaced, another major with a name of Taylor come in and replaced him, making that battalion having four commanders in one day. That'll wow. Never happen again in the history of our world, I don't guess, what have you. Anyway, we took that Hill 131, 2nd Battalion took Hill 95, and now it's about July the 5th or something like that. And I guess it was about July the 9th or 10th, all action ceased for the 508. We were to be boarded up. Got on LST, went back to Nottingham, England, took a 7-day leave, and got ready to jump in Operation Market Garden, which was Nijmegen, Holland. So, and then, that's about my story from the time that I got in that C-47 to jump until they took us out, sent us back to England, you know, what have you. Now, the Normandy campaign lasted 75 days, but a tremendous cost to both sides. We lost 39,000 Americans killed in Normandy. That's a big figure, but nothing compared to what the Germans lost. This is right out of the history book. The Germans lost 250,000 killed in Normandy, 450,000 wounded. And compared to our 39,000 wounded and 39,000 killed and 250,000 wounded for the Allied troops, what have you. So anyway, about closes, you know, Normandy campaign. Now, as I said, we jumped with 2,052 officers and men. We come back to Nottingham, England, held a formation. We had 882 men.
That's it.
Another thing that's an outstanding thing in my mind always, and I didn't know it until I got up on Hill 30, which was D plus 4, I found out the 1st Battalion, 508, my unit, the entire chain of command was killed on D-Day. Not wounded, not prisoner of war, all of them killed. The battalion commander, Colonel Batchelor, my company commander, Captain Ruddy, my platoon leader, Lieutenant Snee, my first sergeant, Snuffy Smith, and my sergeant, Alvin C. Carter, all killed on D. So anyway, since there was no replacements coming in to the 82nd, 101st during that time, everybody had to step up one grade. Some of them later on got killed also, so they stepped up two grades, you know. So anyway, that was about the end of it, you know. We, in fact, we come out with, like I say, 882, and that was a 70% casualty. I don't know the other regiments in the divisions I was attached to, which was the 507 and the 505 and the 325, if they had the same amount of casualties as my regiment. I don't know, but I do know we had 70%, you know, casualties, which is a little heavy, you know.
Do you recall anything about the area that we're sitting today and where you're staying, La Fierre?
How's that?
Do you recall anything about the area in which you're sitting today, La Fierre?
No, I don't. I guess, from that drop zone there that I'm supposed to hit, I flew over it, thank God, and I guess I was probably 2.5 miles on down the road from here, you know.
And would it be your belief that the fields in this area mostly would have been flooded, including the one behind you? You think that
we had no knowledge that they'd be flooded? No,
not during your drop. This most likely would have been flooded. This field behind you.
I don't know. I don't know. I understand the question.
What I'm asking is, do you believe that these fields that you see around today in La Fierre were flooded?
No, it don't look like it could be flooded with a Meredith River, I guess that is. It's called the Meredith River. Hell, there's some place you could almost jump across it. You wouldn't believe it today, looking at that drop zone right out there would be 4 feet of water.
Yeah.
It's, you know, and a lot of our people drowned. They couldn't get out, even the good swimmers. Keep in mind, they had 100 pounds of equipment on them, and they had no knowledge that the drop zone was under flooded, you know. And it was awful dark when we dropped. The only daylight I had was when that C-47 caught on fire and lit up my area. And when it did, it allowed me to find my equipment bundle, you know. I kicked it out the door myself, you know, and I followed it down. But there's so many tracers coming in there, you didn't know. My equipment bundle had a green light on it, but they was colors, looked like a 4th of July, red, green, blue, you name them, they all kinds of colors in the world coming up there. So that green light didn't help me a bit, you know. But when I landed, I could see this equipment bundle within that 10 acres of real estate, you know. There was only one land there. You know.
And you landed by yourself. And
yeah.
Coming down 400, at 400 feet, you're coming down pretty fast, right?
Oh, yeah, you are. You get it opens and it swings about one time, and you're on the ground, you know.
And while you're coming down, you saw tracer fire?
Oh, yeah. Well, our plane was hit. Yeah. Our plane was hit. And, you know, we were told to go in to Normandy. That if a guy got wounded in the plane, we used to hook him up and throw him out because everything was moving forward. There's nothing going to be in the rear. Big mistake. We also had the M1 rifle in a Griswold container, in a Ziploc bag called a Griswold container, broken down in two parts. You had to hit the ground, get out of your chute, unzip it, put your weapon together before you could ever fire. Well, they changed that going into Operation Market Garden. We dropped the M1 rifle over your shoulder, put together over your shoulder, muzzle down, 8 rounds of clips in it, and they issued everybody, including the private all the way up to the colonel, an Army 45 that you carried on your left hip with 8 clips in it ready to go, and we had the quick release to snap and get out. That we had going into to Holland. You know, Operation Market Garden, that we didn't have into Normandy. If we'd had that, some of them people wouldn't have drowned. They could have hit that, and, you know, and the chute would have gone, and they could have probably got out. At least some of the good swimmers could, you know.
So those are some lessons learned from the Normandy
drop.
Oh,
yeah, yeah.
The the theme of the project is war and peace. And some say that war is hell. Do you agree with that statement?
Oh, yeah, I do. I'll tell you who coined that phrase. President Roosevelt did. He said, war is hell. Eleanor thinks war is hell, you know. I think he's the one that coined that phrase, you know, war is hell, you know. Maybe him and Artie Murphy, you know.
Okay. And do you have any personal experiences about how war is hell for you?
How it done what?
Do you have any personal experiences that you could elaborate on how war is hell?
Well, I can only think about it, I guess, here in Normandy. I even went into Vietnam when I had 30 years in the Army, and there's nothing compared to the invasion of the Normandy campaign. I doubt that very few people in America realizes how important or how big a war that the invasion of Normandy was. I seen where they'd cut some of our people's throat, you know, in Germany. Germans did. I think we made a big mistake. We did, by saying we wouldn't take no prisoners. We had no place for them. You know, we are airborne. After 24 hours, they could take, the first 24 hours, we didn't take no prisoners. Well, that word got to Germany. Germany said that too, also. And then the word got out that they'd killed one of our chaplains. Same chaplain that I went to memorial service yesterday afternoon at 4 o'clock. Well, you know, then the killing started again, you know. I had a prisoner, I told you we captured a prisoner on a listening post that told us that was his battalion in front of us. When we turned him over to the S3, the sergeant in S3 killed him with a Thompson submachine gun within 3 minutes after I turned him over. And he said, the SOBs killed my chaplain. You know, that rumor's got around. We finally got that stopped. But, you know, after that, I don't know, I guess probably a week after the Normandy invasion, the killing started, stopped from when we started taking prisoners. They started taking prisoners and what have you, see. But, you know, the first 24 hours, they wasn't taking any and we wasn't taking any. We were told not to. But we did. We took that one kid. He was 16 years old. A German soldier, 16 years old. And he would inform us when the Boche was coming in on their attack, when we was pinned down in there, 2 o'clock in the morning. He'd tell us, Boche is coming. And we'd fire our final protective lines and we'd repel the attack. And the German, he'd always tell, bless the heart, we turned him over when he got up on Hill 130, and the intelligence platoon that got him killed him 50 feet from the time we turned him over, you know, all because the guy was crying that the Germans had killed his chaplain, you know, and it happened, it had to be this chaplain down here because he was the only chaplain killed in the Normandy campaign. You know? So anyway, I would say the first 7 days in Normandy was hell. I mean, hell, what have you. What you've seen, we had, I think one day after we got up on Hill 130, we policed our drop zone a little bit, and we would find paratroopers hanging in trees with their throats cut and all that. That didn't go too good with a 20-year-old squad leader or a 19-year-old squad leader, and especially when they'd been told that their chaplain got killed or something like that, you know. But anyway, after that, they got it squared down, and we started taking prisoners, and they did too, and what have you. And Holland Drop, compared to this, no comparison whatsoever. Of course, this was a night drop. Holland was a day drop in a Sunday afternoon, right?
All right, you were telling me about how war is hell, how you agreed with that statement.
Yeah.
Did this impact you at all after the war?
Oh yeah, it did.
How so?
I'm drawing disability on nightmares and stuff like that. 50% disability. And, you know, they asked me, yeah, didn't you take, yeah, I took training after doctors after World War II, but it didn't do no good. So I just had to live with it, you know. I said, yeah. You still have nightmares? Yeah, I certainly do. I said, how many? I'll have a couple of weeks every night, you know, a couple of weeks. And so, like I say, of course, in Vietnam, when I went there, I was a command sergeant major. And, you know, you're a command sergeant major, get a better assignment. There's a lot of people see the enemy before they get to you. You know what I mean? If you're a command sergeant major. So anyway, I spent a little over 35 years in the Army, retired in 77, you know. And then I retired out of civilian life, I guess, in 85, I think, something like that. You know, I went into real estate, you know, didn't like that, but anyway. Oh, here comes my son Jerry, you know, like he's got him.
Nope. We're wrapping up the interview right now.
Okay, I'm headed to Bayonne to pick up our driving pass, Dad.
Yeah.
It'll take me an hour to get there and an hour to get back.
Yeah.
So if you want to go to Pickleville for the 10 o'clock, if there's somebody here going, you can go. Otherwise, I should be back here a little after 11. There's a machine gun demonstration. Be right there.
What's going on in Pickleville?
I'm not exactly sure. It's probably a dedication ceremony like
went
to yesterday. So, you know, if you want to go, if there's somebody here, it's going to take you over there, that'd be fine. Otherwise, just stay here and rest, okay?
I guess you should have told Vivian this guy's coming.
I did tell her last night. It didn't matter to her.
Well, she didn't tell us nothing, you know. All right.
She's not. No, she's upset that I invited somebody without talking to her first. But she wasn't here.
Yeah.
So.
That's all right.
She'll get over it.
Yeah.
All right, Patrick, glad you found your place. Nice to meet you. I hopefully won't get lost.
All right.
So, even to this day, 70 years after D-Day, you still have reflections and nightmares about it.
Yeah.
It's a very impactful event.
Well, it's all the people that I guess I lost here now, you know. I was a squad leader. I lost all of them except one man in Normandy. And then they promoted me to buck sergeant, so now I've got 20 men, you know, instead of a squad. And I lost a lot of those on in Holland, on Hill, Devil's Hill, they called it, in Holland, you know, and what have you. So, of course, then I lost a lot in the Battle of Bulge. We're still going on in World War II, you know. And I got the Silver Star on the 4th of July, you know. When we was holding that base of the Hill 131 I was telling you about?
Yes.
There was a machine gun keep on raking the front of us, you know. And I had this water cooler, and one of the bullets pierced the water jacket of the water cooler machine gun. All the water held 9 pints, so it was inactive. That machine gun was no good. You know, we had to replace the whole gun whenever we got changed. So anyway, I was attached to Lieutenant Lieutenant from A Company, and I told him, So I'm going to take, I went back to see Leonard Funk, the Medal of Honor winner of the C Company 508. This is before he got the, he was in reserve. His company was in reserve, had A and B Company online, and a rifle company in the Airborne in World War II was 198 men. C Company was in the reserve, total strength, 37 men out of 198. And Leonard Funk said, I got some grenades here, Rock, you can take a case or two off your own. I took a half a case of gammon grenades, half a case of fragmentation. A gammon grenade was a grenade that was prevented and made by the British. It was a C2 composition, rolled up about the size of a softball, had a cap on it. He unscrewed the cap, and I could hit a tank from me to you. Nothing would come back to me. Everything would go forward. So I took half a dozen of them and left my rifle there at the thing, and I crawled out there 1,000 yards and blew this damn machine gun up, you know, what have you, and come back. And that was, they put me in for the Silver Star, so I got it. That was a second machine gun nest that I knocked out. I knocked out one on D-Day, where we got, first time we got pinned down, and the Lieutenant Abbott told me to take two men and go out there and knock out a machine gun. I did. I didn't get nothing for that. Adams got killed the next day. I mean, Abbott did, you know. And so I put in the PFC that threw the gamma grenade. He got the Bronze Star with valor. Bless his heart, and he got killed in the Battle of Bulge, named PFC James, you know. But he, I didn't get nothing, but he got it for it. So, because he's the one who threw the machine, threw the grenade, not me. All me and the other guy, which I didn't know, we just laid down a base of fire while he crawled up there and got in range with, you know, knocked it out. So anyway, but, so.
So a lot of the, say the trauma that you have is due to your fallen comrades.
Yeah.
And how do you feel coming back when you go to these memorials now?
Well, it's bad. I can hold my exposure until I get in the American Cemetery in Omaha Beach. When I was there in 202, 1st Battalion 508 out of Italy brought me over here, and we went through the battlefields, and we took them around to Captain Ruddy. My company commander got killed. One of my sergeants got killed. I went to their graves and what have you. I kind of cracked up on that. But I hold my exposure pretty good around here, you know, what have you. But I can't handle that cemetery, you know, what have you.
It's yeah. Very tough on you.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
The opposite side of war sometimes is peace. Did you ever experience any peaceful moments during Normandy?
Oh yeah, we did. When I got to Hill 130, Hill 30, assembled on D plus 3 or 4, and I got a hot meal, got the new water cooled machine guns and what have you, and took a piece there until I found out my entire chain of command was knocked out or was killed. Then it's this, I don't know, the fear or something come right back to you then, you know, what have you. But then Holland was a good operation as far as Americans are concerned. If you read the history, you'll say Operation Market Garden was a failure. Because you look and see what the 82nd, the 101st, they took every mission they was told to take. The only people that failed was the British 1st Airborne Division that supposed to took Arnhem that failed, you know. So they marked the whole operation a failure, but it wasn't. That was a good operation as far as I'm concerned. The Battle of Bulls, that wasn't so good because not only was we fighting the enemy, we was fighting the weather. We were not fit, ready to go into that combat area environment with no all-weather gear. We didn't have, you know, we just went out. So we were fighting two elements when you went in there, you know. So that was bad. And like I said, to answer your question, the good war I call Holland 66 days a good war, as far as I was concerned, you know. We've got every mission we just promised, you know, to take. So, you know, Normandy was hell, and the Battle of Bulge was hell because the worst part was the weather. All the people was losing with frostbitten feet and stuff like that, you know. We was fighting two different wars, as far as I was concerned, you know.
Sure. Did you experience any acts of kindness during the war?
From prisoners or for?
From, could be civilians, could be your comrades.
Well, the French people here, the underground, they were great for us. So was the Dutch underground in Nijmegen, Holland, up in there. They were kindness to us and treated us, you know, with kindness, walking down the streets, trying to give you champagne and fruit and all that good stuff. Because we were in the city of Nijmegen, I was not in no big cities in France. You know, I was just in villages and small, but in Nijmegen's a pretty good city. And so I marched right through the city of Nijmegen with a section of machine guns and thousands of people was there, you know. And I remember we were watching the people around us, and all of a sudden, the German machine gun, just before we got to the bridge in Holland, fired right down that highway where we was at. And I looked around, I didn't see a civilian nowhere. All I seen was 20 paratroopers laying flat on their belly, 10 on one side of the street and 10 on the other, you know. But anyway, to answer your question, yeah, they, both of them done good, but I was, like I say, I wasn't presented too much to the underground here in France. I just didn't have a chance like I was in Nijmegen, you know.
And did you have any kind of interaction with any of the civilians? So the
here,
farmers?
Oh, yeah. I, D-Day, daylight, my gunner, PFC Stevens, laying out in the field there, his chute shield attached to him, his back broken, two legs broken. I picked him up and I took him to a farmer's house. And they didn't want to take him. They had to be on the winning side. You understand that? You know, they didn't know whether we was going to win or the Germans were going to win. They had to be on the winning side. But they took him anyway. The Germans come by and captured him. And then the Americans come by and retook him from it. And they sent him back to the hospitals all the way back to Harlem County, Kentucky. And I got a letter from him. And they discharged him out of the Army with a 100 disability, you know, what have you. But that family, they took him. They didn't want to. But I could understand that. They had to be on the winning tide, you know.
Well, they were under occupation for 4 years.
Yeah.
They were a little frightened, I'm sure.
So they knew them. They knew them, you know. So anyway, what then? So.
Anything else you'd like to add that I haven't asked you?
I don't think so. But you edit that. If anything you want to take out of, you have my permission. They may not like the order that my S2 killed my prisoner, you know. I even told the French TV station, same thing. They probably edit that out. They probably don't want it out, but I'm just telling you what happened.
No, that.
So if you want it in there, all well and good. If you want to take it out, That's good too, you know.
And I understand that you've got a, you still have a position with the 508th.
What is that? Honorary Command Sergeant Major, the 508th. And believe it or not, they deactivated the 508 10 days ago. And I was there in the general, which is here, two-star. He passed the colors to me. And like he said yesterday, I told him, General, if the rough gets going again and you need the 508, we'll be ready to go. So he thanked me for that and what have you. So now I'm not the honorary command sergeant major of the 508, because we don't have no 508. They're deactivated. But who knows? They could call them back to active duty anytime, you know.